Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We often think about heredity as pieces of our own personal puzzle. She has her mother's laugh, he has his father's eyes. You know, small components of our parents and ancestors that help make up who we are as individuals. But puzzles are funny things. You know, they're made up of pieces with regular, fixed patterns that then form a somewhat predictable final image. But according to New York Times science columnist and author Carl Zimmer, heredity isn't a rudimentary puzzle. In fact, it's dynamic, subject to many forces, both biological and environmental. And he writes about it in his new book. It's called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. And it looks at the history of heredity, the science of inheritance as it stands now, and where it might go. And Carl Zimmer joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I use that puzzle analogy there. Is it a fair one that heredity isn't as simple as interlocking pieces of a puzzle?
Heredity is something we're all fascinated with, and it's something that I think we all think we know. But the closer you look at it, the more you realize it's incredibly mysterious and turns your assumptions upside down left and right.
Okay, well, so let's start with some of the basics. The common understanding that I get half of my genes from my mom or the male side, half of the genes from the female side, and it comes down through the family tree, et cetera. I mean, is that, that's factually correct, but what's wrong about that in understanding heredity?
Oh, no, that's a great place to start. Yeah. You know, I mean, high school genetics is a fantastic place to get started, but, you know, how is it that 50% of your DNA you get from your parents, your mother, and 50% from your father make you look kind of like them in some ways and not in others? You know, why is it that you might look a lot like your great-grandparent? You know, I'm tall and my brother is tall. My parents are not. And so we're always saying, like, well, where'd you get that from? You know, mm-hmm. as if there's some like sort of magical height token that gets passed along the generations, then pops up. And when you actually look at what scientists are learning about how heredity flows down through the generations, it's fascinating in just how complex it goes. It's like a river that's weaving around in and of itself.
Okay, but it's still genetically determined, right? It's just, is it the expression of some of those traits kind of pop up only under certain circumstances?
Or? Well, you know, the genes are certainly part of the story of how you are, how you turned out. I mean, part of it is also, you know, what environment are those genes in? So you might have genes that might make you taller than average under certain circumstances, but if, you know, you're growing up without enough nutrition, you're never going to see that. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that all over the world, everyone is several inches taller now than they were 100 years ago. It's not because they inherited super tall genes. It's just because life got better.
Right. I mean, not to make this about me, but both my parents, they're immigrants from India. They grew up very poor in India. My dad, love him. He's 5'5", I think. My mom is 5'1" when she's standing straight up. And my family, their kids and all my cousins were all significantly taller than my parents. And I asked my dad about this one day years ago, why he thinks that is. And he looked at me straight in the eye. He's like, medical care and not having, the first 10 years of your life be a struggle with constant, you know, amoebic dysentery for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's totally true. It's totally true.
Okay. But so then, you know, if we take into account the import of these environmental factors that can influence the expression of genes, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's a big
okay,
part of it.
Okay, so but then I also read that you're saying that, for example, if we go back up a family tree to any one of our ancestors, that maybe there's a 50-50 chance that we may not actually share any genetic material from them?
The further back you go, the more ancestors you have. So if you go, say, about 10 generations back, you have over 1,000 ancestors. The problem is, in terms of genes, is that you're only inheriting, you know, one copy of each gene from each parent. And so you repeat that over many generations. And after a while, some ancestors won't be leaving any DNA in a descendant at all. So actually, scientists have done some math on this, and they estimate about half of your ancestors 10 generations back, you have no genetic connection to at all. They're still your ancestors, but you have no genetic link to them. So, you know, we tend to look at, say that, you know, ancestry and kinship are exactly equal to genes, and they're not. It's more complicated than that.
So tell me more. What would you say? If it is more complicated than that, are you saying that we should be considering ancestry as culture and history as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, you are definitely a part of history. Whether or not you have genetic connection to people in the past is another question mm-hmm. altogether. So I think, you know, we should think of ourselves as inheriting culture and inheriting history, along with inheriting some genes. We need a bigger, broader definition of heredity to really appreciate how we got to where we are.
Yeah. So, but then the power, maybe the cultural power of trying to trace ancestry and proving genetic links to certain people, whatever, is very, very strong. I mean, just look at the whole, like, the enormous business around taking a cheek swab and sending it off in the mail and finding out who you might be related to. Why do you think it has such power?
I think because we have come to basically equate genes with ancestry, and we think that we are going to discover who we are in some ultimate sense by taking a cheek swab. And the numbers are incredible. Ancestry.com alone has 10 million customers. 23andMe has 5 million. And most of that growth was in the last year. So this is incredibly explosive. And it's exciting that lots of people are going to be getting to look at their own DNA. This is the first time in history this has ever been possible. But, you know, when people look at that, I want to encourage people to sort of think more broadly about what they're looking at. You know, I mean, if you 23andMe tells you you're 2% Neanderthal, what does that mean? Is that different than being 1% Neanderthal? Really? You know, you have to really ask yourself, what are these numbers actually telling you? Because it can be tricky. You can get the wrong impression.
Mm. Now, you sequenced your own genome.
Yeah, I went sort of beyond the 23andMe kind of thing. And I actually got my whole genome, every single genetic letter sequenced, and took it, the raw data, to scientists and said, help me, you know, like, what does this mean? And it was a fascinating experience. I talk about it in the book.
Well, so tell me a little bit more. First of all, what was it like to, I mean, did it come, this is such a rudimentary question, forgive me, but did it come back to you in the form of, you know, that barcode-y looking thing of, you know, your DNA, or was it ATCGs? What was it when you got your genome sequence?
Well, it showed up as an external hard drive, so a little metal box.
Okay, it was a hard drive. Okay.
And on it was basically the spreadsheet from hell, like basically billions of rows, each with a little bit of genetic sequence in it. And then I would go to scientists, and they would help show me how they piece it together to show me what my actual sequence was. And then we take the next step and say, like, okay, so what did you inherit?
And what did you find out?
Well, one interesting thing is that I inherited a gene from one of my parents. I don't know which, but thank you, because it's a protective gene. We always think of these mutations as being dangerous and harmful, but there are some that are actually very beneficial. So I, it turns out, have one that actually gives me a strong protection against certain autoimmune diseases. And as I was looking into this more, having discovered this, it turned out that drug companies have been using that knowledge about that mutation to develop a drug to treat autoimmune diseases. There's that connection there that I have from, you know, my own genes to drug discovery, which was really cool. And then also, I think, you know, it was very interesting to go to a researcher who studies Neanderthals, and for him to basically give me a catalog of my Neanderthal genes. So, you know, I'm about 1.2% Neanderthal, which is typical. But to actually, like, see which genes I happen to have from Neanderthals, inheriting them after 60, 70,000 years, was very cool.
Now, since you mentioned Neanderthals, are any of those genes expressing themselves? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Neanderthal genes still express themselves.
Yes. And in you, too. Yeah. I mean, basically, Neanderthals interbred with humans when humans expanded out of Africa. So basically, anybody who has ancestry outside of Africa has roughly 1% Neanderthal DNA. So you've got some.
Wow. That's great. I mean, so that's a form of inheritance as well.
Absolutely.
You know, before I get, we should definitely talk about sort of the road ahead here, which is vitally important. But I don't want to skip over the fact that, I mean, because you go through the history of how societies and cultures have engaged with our emerging knowledge of genetic inheritance and heredity and how frequently it's been used for very darker purposes, you know, eugenics, the Nazis' idea of a superior race. A lot of the quote-unquote science that was done in the United States in the 19th century around eugenics, for example. I mean, why has science repeatedly gone in that direction as well?
Well,
it's been used in that direction, I should say.
It has been. Yeah. And I think that, you know, scientists are working in societies and they are products of that society. And so you scientists may come into their research with a lot of assumptions. And so, you know, there a number of, you know, white American scientists around 1900 went into their, you know, discovered genetics with an assumption that they were superior. The whites were superior. So genetics was going to show them that. Many of them believed that, you know, genes would explain things that they kind of felt that they already knew, that, for example, intelligence was entirely inherited. And so, you know, feeble-mindedness must be entirely genetic as well. And so they looked for the answers that they wanted to find.
Yeah. So moving forward now, we're in the era of potential gene editing, right? Or I shouldn't even say potential. Like it's a developed science now.
It's happening right here in Boston.
And, you know, CRISPR, we've talked about that on this show a lot. It makes me wonder, does that mean that the entire notion of heredity or genetic inheritance is soon going to be in moot?
Well, the thing is that, you know, heredity is not something that follows certain laws like the law of gravity or something like that. I mean, heredity is just, as we know, it's just something that evolved and it's different from species to species and it can be manipulated. And that's just a fact. And so, yes, it is possible for us now to step into the DNA of a plant or an animal and change the genes, and then they'll pass that down. There are other ways in which we can override sort of regular heredity. You know, a person, it will probably become possible soon for people to take a cheek scraping and convert those cells into eggs or sperm.
Just from a cheek scraping.
Yeah. You turn them back into stem cells and then you turn them into eggs or sperm. And it might even be possible, say, for a man to generate eggs and sperm just from his own cells and then fertilize that. And then you have an embryo and then you take a cell out of that embryo and make more eggs and sperm and then fertilize them. And what do you have? And what would you call that? It's sort of beyond the language of heredity that we were accustomed to. But these things are becoming conceivable as stem cells and CRISPR come online.
I mean, it's such a cliche, but Brave New World is what I would call it at the very least. Not that it's all negative, but it does introduce a raft of ethical, societal concerns that we need to be grappling with.
And I don't think we're talking about it anywhere near enough. We just sort of talk about science fiction a bit and then kind of move on. But these things are going to be potentially happening very soon. And is it going to be something that governments are going to get involved in? Is it okay to let the marketplace drive these decisions, just leave it up to parents? Is it okay for parents to basically enhance their IVF child? We have to decide.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't want to fall into the trap, which I could, of being very doom and gloom about the whole thing. Because, I mean, you also write about how with this same technology and these possibilities, we could enter a future where there are no hereditary diseases whatsoever. Could we?
Well, conceivably, if you had a huge global campaign and you basically forced everybody to do IVF and that sort of thing, yeah, maybe you could do that. It seems a little far-fetched to me. And honestly, I think we also have big issues to think about that I would argue are other kinds of heredity. You know, we have inherited a planet that's very altered from before, you know, our species started putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the Industrial Revolution. And we're going to pass down that planet to future generations. That's a kind of cultural heredity. And I think we should think about intervening there as well to basically make sure that this planet is livable. Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about things like, you know, what's going to happen with CRISPR, I think we have to balance it with the other issues that the future faces.
How far could we take this, though, with CRISPR and gene editing? Because, again, I can't tell if the question I'm about to ask is just utterly ridiculous, but, you know, part of the magic, quote-unquote magic of evolution comes through that random assortment of genes that you don't really fully know what you're going to get when you cross, whether it be runner beans or people. But if we can control genomic material through gene editing to an incredibly fine point, I mean, are we potentially messing with evolution?
I don't think so, okay. Simply because there are 7 billion people on Earth. There are hundreds of millions of kids born all the time. And you just have to imagine, again, every single kid being produced out of a lab. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think that, you know, humanity is going to continue to produce new mutations the old-fashioned way and continue to evolve the old-fashioned way, even if some CRISPR-altered people start walking among us.
Okay.
That's my view.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And sometimes in these conversations, I find myself casting a net really, really far out there just to explore what's out there.
It's not that far. That's the thing. It's like these things are things that we ought to be talking about.
Yeah. Well, Carl Zimmer is science columnist for The New York Times. He's author of the new book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. He's going to be talking about his book tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7. And by the way, Carl, you should know that Carrie Goldberg, who runs our Common Health section here at WBUR, she's a great science journalist, she said, Carl Zimmer's coming in? The most important science journalist in America? Of course you should have him on. So so you've got fans here in this building.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.